welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast, the penultimate podcast before my tour starts, and I'm probably not going to be on mic for some time. That tour is coming up soon, February the 14th. I'm doing two events in Boston on opposite ends of the city. So I will be at BossCon, the science fiction convention. It's their free admission day, so you can just come. And I'm going to be there late in the afternoon on February the 14th. Later in the evening, I'm going to be at the Brookline Booksmith with Ken Liu, also in the Boston area. February the 15th, I'm doing a live cast with Yanis Varoufakis. That's on a Saturday afternoon, depending on what time zone you're in. And that's hosted by Jacobin. On the 17th of February, I will be in Menlo Park at Kepler's Bookstore with Charlie Jane Anders. The next day, the 18th of February, I'll be in Los Angeles at Diesel Bookstore with Will Wheaton. The 19th of February, I will be in Seattle with Dan Savage at Third Place Books. The 23rd of February, I will be in Toronto to do a bookstore event at Another Story. And on the 24th, very limited admission, I'm going to be giving the Ursula Franklin Lecture in Toronto at the University of Toronto. The 26th of February, I will be in New York City at the Strand with John Hodgman. The 27th of February, I will be at Penn State in Pennsylvania. The 1st of March, I will be in Doylestown, Pennsylvania at the Doylestown Bookshop. The 2nd of March, I'll be at Red Emma's in Baltimore. The 4th of March, I will be at the DC Public Library with Matt Stoller. The 5th of March, I will be at Fountain Bookstore in Richmond, Virginia with Lee Vinsel. The 10th of March, I will be at First Light Books in Austin. I'm also doing a bunch of events at South by Southwest if you're there. The 13th of March, I'll be back in Burbank at Dark Delicacies for a bookstore event there. The 17th through 20th of March, I'm going to be at Europa Park near Stuttgart for Cloudfest. The 24th of March, I'm doing a remote event for the Imagine Festival in Belfast. On the 2nd of April, I'm going to be at Exile in Bookville in Chicago, and I'm staying in Chicago for the 3rd of April to appear at the ABA Tech Show and give the keynote. The 4th of April, I'm off to Bloomington, Indiana to speak at Morgenstern Books. And then later on in the year, 20th through 22nd of June, I'm going to be in Portland, Oregon for the Teardown Conference, and I will also be doing an event, date TBC, at Powell's Books. And next October, 10th through 12th, I'm going to be in New Orleans to be the guest of honor at Deep South Con 63. There's also some tentative gigs that are not yet finalized. I might be in Atlanta around the 26th of March to do both a conference speech and a bookstore event. And I'm also negotiating whether I'm going to end up in New Zealand to do some bookstore events and a big library conference. Remains to be seen. So I'm recording this on the 2nd of February. It is the day before my daughter's 17th birthday. We have just seen her off for her weekly volunteer gig at the LA Zoo, and we got her special croissants and tarts, her favorite, from our local bakery, Lou the French, on the block, where you have to go and line up half an hour before they open if you want to get them before they sell out. It's been really good. And if you hear any funny noises in the background, it's because we are having a new range hood installed in our kitchen, and the guys just got here to do that. My wife is very sensitive to smoke in the house, and I like to cook, and this is a source of some friction. We had an over-the-counter microwave with a really wimpy little range extractor underneath it, and we were replacing it with effectively a jet engine that is going to suck all of the air out of our kitchen and, if we're not careful, asphyxiate us all, because there will be nothing left, we're told, with the power of this new amazing range hood. So that's being fitted right now. I'm very excited. So today I'm going to read to you a recent post from my Pluralistic newsletter about the tariff war between Canada and the United States. And as I'm saying this, Justin Trudeau, the erstwhile Prime Minister of Canada, has just announced that Canada is going to impose retaliatory tariffs on the United States to punish Trump for putting tariffs on Canadian goods. This is an unbelievably bad idea, as you will hear. It's just going to make things very expensive for Canadians, and it's wild that Justin Trudeau has not learned the lesson that if prices go up while you are in power, people will hate you a lot and will go for your opponent. I think that is what is likely to happen in the coming election. Also, Justin Trudeau announced that he was going to resign and that he would have an election eventually, not exactly when he was going to have an election. And then he did this thing called proroguing Parliament, which is when you basically send Parliament home Canada currently does not have a legislature. They've all been sent home, and they're not coming back until after the next election. This is to, I guess, stop a snap election from being called through a vote of no confidence or whatever. But boy, this moment where Canada is in this unprecedented trade war with its largest partner is not a great fucking time to not have a legislature. Jesus Christ, is this ever reckless? And of course, for everyone who thinks that constitutional monarchies are great, let me remind you that you cannot prorogue parliament in Canada without the Governor General, that is to say, the Queen's representative, or I guess the King's representative now, who's supposed to be the adult supervision to stop this shit from happening, without them saying okay. And the GG said okay. This is exactly what happened the last time there was a just unbelievably reckless proroguing, which is when Stephen Harper, the Conservative Prime Minister, you're going to hear a little about in today's reading, Stephen Harper prorogued Parliament because there was an inquiry into Canadian complicity with torture and extrajudicial killings in Afghanistan, and it was going really bad for his government, so he just shut down Parliament. And the problem was that was just as the financial crisis was unfolding. And so in 2008, Canada went into the financial crisis without a legislature. I mean, this is so unbelievably reckless. I can't believe how bad this is. But I'm going to be talking today about another thing that we could do to retaliate against the United States, something that would not make prices go up in Canada, something that would be good for Canadians, in fact, make things go down and would hit Americans where it hurt, hit the Americans where their richest people who back Trump make all their money. And what's interesting about the policy proposal I'm going to have, which is in a nutshell changing Canadian IP laws, is that it's a pretty good conservative policy as well as a liberal policy. At the root of this reform is just the idea that, like, if you own, say, an iPhone, you should be in charge of which app store you buy stuff from because it's your property. And property rights, the last I checked, they're a pretty conservative idea. And so there is some scope, I think, even for the presumptive next prime minister of Canada, who's Pierre Poilievre, who's basically smart Trump. He's awful. But there's some scope for him doing this, too. At least we can hope. Not least because while the law that Canada has that I'm saying we should get rid of is a law that was passed by a conservative government, by Stephen Harper's government, it had previously been attempted by two successive liberal governments. And a liberal member of parliament, a woman called Sam Bulte, had floated this proposal over and over again and had in fact freaked out when asked about it in a town hall meeting when she was asked why she was carrying water for the Americans. And she started screaming and she said, "I will not be intimidated by user right zealots and Electronic Frontier Foundation members. I'm not making this up." People put user right zealot signs on their lawn during that election cycle. And her riding, which is what Canadians call electoral districts, turned over and went to the New Democratic Party, the left party in Canada, in part because of this, because Sam Bulte really read the room so badly. So this is a policy that conservatives could credibly say they were going to undertake because they don't like what the liberal government that preceded Justin Trudeau wanted, right? That this is a thing that has no necessary political valence that says you can't do this if you're a liberal or a conservative. So I'm really hoping that this will get some traction, this idea. I was on national radio twice last week. I'm going to be on Canada Land's podcast next week, probably around the time this drops. And I think that if Canadians start talking about this, there's some scope for doing this. And I also think that other countries that are facing Trump tariffs could adopt this policy quite usefully, most notably Mexico. So I think it's kind of a race to see which country decides that they're going to run with this first, because they're going to have an enormous advantage. And I think it could be Canada. Anyway, I've talked a lot around what this week's podcast is about, but now I should get to the reading. And so without further ado, from the January 15th edition of Pluralistic.net, this is Canada Shouldn't Retaliate with U.S. Tariffs. Five years ago, Trump touted his big, beautiful replacement for NAFTA, the free trade agreement between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. Trump's NAFTA II was called the USMCA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, and it was pretty similar to NAFTA, to be honest. That tells you a couple things. First, NAFTA was, broadly speaking, a good thing for Trump and the ultra-wealthy donors who backed him and got far richer as a result. That's why he kept it intact. NAFTA and USMCA are at root a way to make rich people richer by making poorer people poorer. Trump's base hated NAFTA because they correctly believed that it was being used to erode wages by chasing cheaper labor and more lax environmental controls in other countries. Neither NAFTA nor USMCA have any stipulations requiring exported goods to be manufactured by unionized workers or in factories with robust environmental and workplace safety rules. The point of NAFTA slash USMCA is to goose profits by despoiling the environment, maiming workers, stealing their wages, paying them less, all while poisoning the earth. Trump's new NAFTA was just the old NAFTA with some largely cosmetic changes so that Trump's base could be, temporarily, fooled into thinking that Trump was righting the historic wrong of NAFTA. However, there was one part of USMCA that marked a big departure from NAFTA, the IP chapter. USMCA bound Canada and Mexico to implementing new, brutal IP laws. For example, Mexico was forced to pass an anti-circumvention law that makes it a crime to tamper with digital locks. This means that Mexican mechanics can't bypass the locks U.S. car companies use to lock out third-party repair. Mexican farmers can't fix their own tractors. And of course, Mexican software developers can't make alternative app stores for games consoles and mobile devices. They must sell their software through U.S. big tech companies that take 30% of every sale. Shamefully, Canada had already capitulated to most of these demands. Two Canadian Conservative Party politicians, Tony Clement and James Moore, had sold the country out in 2012, throwing away 6,138 negative responses to a consultation on their new digital locks law on the grounds that they were, quote, babyish views of, quote, radical extremists, siding instead with 54 cranks and industry shills who supported their proposal in the consultation. When Canadian politicians are pressed on why these anti-interoperability, anti-repair policies are good for Canada, they'll say it's a condition of free trade and the benefit of being able to export Canadian goods to the U.S. without tariffs outweighs the cost of having to pay rents to American companies for consumables like car parts or printer ink, repair, and software sales. Sure. When Canadian software authors sell iPhone apps to Canadian customers, the payments take a round trip through Cupertino, California, and come back 30% short. But Canadian consumers get to buy iPhones without paying tariffs on them, and the oil, timber, and minerals we rip out of the ground can be sent to America without tariffs either. Oh, and also a few things that are still manufactured in Canada can do this too. Enter Trump, carrying a 25% tariff on all Canadian goods, which he has vowed to impose on his first day in office. Obviously, this demands a policy response. What should Canada do when Trump tears up his big, beautiful trade deal and whacks Canadian exporters? One obvious response is to impose a 25% retaliatory tariff on American exporters. After all, Canada and the U.S. are one another's mutual largest trading partners. American businesses rely on selling things to Canadians, so a massive tariff on U.S. goods will certainly make some of Trump's business lobby backers feel pain, and maybe they'll talk some sense into him. I think this would be a huge mistake. The most potent political lesson of the past 4 years is that politicians who preside over rising prices, regardless of their role in causing them, will swiftly feel the wrath of their voters. The public is furious about inflation, whether it comes from transient COVID supply chain shocks, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, or cartels using inflation as a cover for illegal collusive price gouging. Canadians are very reliant on American imports of finished goods. That's another legacy of NAFTA. It crashed Canada's manufacturing sector. Canadian manufacturing companies treat the U.S. as a, quote, nearshore source of non-union labor and weak environmental and safety rules, and they shipped Canadian union jobs to American scabs. Canada's economy is supposedly now all about services, but what we really export is the stuff we tear out of the earth. Countries that are organized around resource extraction don't need fancy social safety nets or an education system capable of producing a high-tech workforce. All you need to extract resources is a hole in the ground surrounded by guns which explains a lot about the shifts in the Canadian political climate since the Mulroney years. Since Canada is now substantially reorganized as an open-pit mine for American manufacturers, cutting off American imports would drive the prices of everyday goods sky high, and it'd be political suicide. But there is another way. Because, of course, Canada, like any other country, has the capacity to make all kinds of things, including high-tech things. Sure, it's unlikely that Canada will launch another Research in Motion with a BlackBerry smartphone that'll put the iPhone and Android in the shade. The mobile duopoly has the market sewn up and can use predatory pricing, refusal to deal, and other anti-competitive tactics to strangle any competitor in its cradle. But you know what Canada could make? A Canadian App Store. That's a store that Canadian software authors could use to sell Canadian apps to Canadian customers, charging, say, the standard payment processing fee of 5%, rather than Apple's 30%. Canada could make app stores for Android, PlayStations, and Xboxes, too. There's no reason that a Canadian app store would have to confine itself to Canadian software authors, either. Canadian app stores could offer 5% commissions on sales to U.S. and global software authors and provide jailbreaking kits that allows device owners all around the world to install the Canadian app stores where the software authors don't get ripped off by American big tech companies. Canadian companies like Honeybee already make front ends for John Deere tractors. These are the components that turn a tractor into a plow or a thresher or another piece of heavy agricultural equipment. Honeybee struggles to constantly get its products to interface with John Deere tractors because Deere uses digital locks to block those products. Canada could produce jailbreaking kits for John Deere tractors too, not just for Honeybee. Every ag tech company in the world would benefit from commercially available, professionally supported John Deere jailbreaking kits. So would farmers, because these kits would restore farmers' right to repair their own tractors. Speaking of repair, Canadian companies could jailbreak every make and model of every U.S. automobile and make independent, constantly updated diagnostic tools that every mechanic in the world could buy for hundreds of dollars, rather than paying the five-figure ransom that car makers charge for their own underpowered junk versions of these tools. Jailbreaking cars doesn't stop with repair either. Cars like the Tesla are basically giant rent extraction machines. If you want to use all the features your Tesla ships with, like access to the full charge in your battery, you have to pay tens of thousands of dollars in subscription fees over the life of the car. And when you sell that car, all that downloadable content is clawed back. No one's going to pay extra to buy your used Tesla just because you spent thousands on manufacturer upgrades, because they're all downgraded when you sign over the pink slip. But Canadian companies could make jailbreaking kits for Teslas that unlock all the features in the car for a single low price. And again, they could sell these to every Tesla owner in the world. Elon Musk doesn't invent anything. He just takes credit for other people's ideas. And that's as true of bad ideas as it is for good ones. Musk didn't invent the extractive Tesla ripoff. He stole it from the inkjet printer companies like HP, who have used the fact that jailbreaking is illegal to turn printer ink into the most expensive fluid in the world, selling it for more than $10,000 a gallon. Canadian companies could sell jailbreaking kits for inkjet printers that disconnect them from subscription services and disable all the anti-features that check for and reject third-party ink. People all over the world would buy these. What's standing in the way of a Canadian industrial policy that focuses on raiding the sky-high margins of American monopolists with third-party add-ons, mods, and jailbreaks? Just the IP laws that Canada has agreed to in order to get tariff-free access to American markets. You know, the access that Trump has promised to end in less than a week's time? Canada should tear up these laws and not impose tariffs on American goods. That way, Canada can still buy cheap American goods, and then they can save billions of dollars every year on the consumables, parts, software, and service for those goods. This is hurting American big business where it hurts, in the ongoing rents it extracts from Canadians through IP laws like Bill C-11, the law that bans jailbreaking. Canada could become a global high-tech export powerhouse, selling complementary goods that disenchidify all the worst practices of U.S. tech monopolists, from car parts to insulin pumps. It's the only kind of trade war that Canadian politicians can win against Americans. The kind where the price of Canadians don't go up because of tariffs, where the price of apps, repair, parts, and upgrades goes way down, and where a new high-tech manufacturing sector pulls in vast sums from customers all over the world. Canada can win this kind of war, even against a country as big and powerful as the USA. After all, we did it once before. And, you know, here I link to a song called The War of 1812, which I'm going to pull up the lyrics for, by the Arrogant Worms, which is a song that Canadians know and love. And I'm just going to sing you a couple of choruses here. I'm not much of a singer, so forgive me, but you'll get the point. Oh, come back, proud Canadians, to before you had TV. No hockey night in Canada. There was no CBC. In 1812, Madison was mad. He was the president, you know. He thought he'd tell the British where they ought to go. He thought that he'd invade Canada. He thought that he was tough. Instead, we went to Washington and burned down all his stuff. And the White House burned. And we're the ones that did it. It burned. While the president ran and cried. It burned. And things were very historical. And the Americans ran and cried like a bunch of little babies. Wah. In the War of 1812. That's all I'm going to sing, but I urge you to look up the rest of it. You know what? If anyone can, like, memorize the lyrics, I might sing it along with you if you come out on my book tour, and we can have a hootenanny. All right, then. Well, that is this week's podcast. You've got one more before the tour starts. Not sure what I'll read yet. I think my next Locust column will be up by then. This is probably what I'm going to read. Blame Canada. A beauty, eh? Talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio, @gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.